Coming up, Michael Nava talks about why it's taken 20 years to see Henry Rios again, and Justine explains once and for all what it means to have a cricket stump shoved up your ass.
Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Justine, before we get to your review, I got a question for you. Do you listen to the Big Gay Fiction podcast?
Oh, yeah. I've been listening to it for a while, and I couldn't believe they were just named 21 of the best book podcasts by Oprah.
And I got to say, it's well-deserved. They're fun to listen to. I want to give a big thank you to Jeff and Will over at the Big Gay Fiction podcast. On their show Monday, they gave a special shout out to us and welcomed us to the world of podcasts and the world of gay podcasting, actually, to be specific, which is growing, which is good news.
It's wonderful news. And it's really great of them to welcome us to the world. They've really laid a lot of the pathway as pioneers.
Yeah, and I've got to tell you, I have learned through this experience that podcasts are a friendly bunch of people, and Jeff and Will are no exception. I appreciate some hand-holding they did for me when I worked to help get this baby off the ground. For listeners, if you enjoy great witty banter about current events and much more, and enjoy romance fiction, I highly suggest you go to biggayfictionpodcast.com. So thank you again, Jeff and Will.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely.
So next I need to do an apology to you.
Yeah, I know.
Last week, Justine tried to tell us what a cricket stump was, and she wasn't exactly sure herself. And Justine actually asked me to edit it out, and I refused to because I thought it was funny. So,
and I grumbled all week about it. And then finally, I had to just go and look up what a cricket stump was.
But you forgive me?
Okay. You're on probation for a while.
Okay. I'll take that. If that's the best I can get, I'll take it. So, okay.
All right.
Tell us what a cricket stump is.
A cricket stump is actually one of the three poles in a cricket wicket. And it's 28 inches high. That sounds like it's going to hurt if it goes up your arse.
Does indeed. So if anybody's curious why we're talking about a cricket stump, last week Justine reviewed Garrick Jones's The Cricketer's Arms. And in that story, the victim was killed by having a cricket stump shoved up his ass.
Things are never quite what they appear.
Oh, really?
That's all you get. You'll have to read the book for the rest.
Okay, and it's next on my list. Am I going to be disappointed?
You won't be disappointed. And he confirmed this week that the second Clive Smith mystery is in the works. So I'm very excited about that.
Okay, yeah, that was the question we had. Okay, so what book are you reviewing today?
I'm reviewing Mystery of the Bones by C.S. Poe. It is the fourth and final book in her Snow and Winter series. And these guys have been through the ringer. In the beginning of the first book, Calvin was in the closet, and now they're engaged. So it's got a romantic arc to it, but the mysteries are just delightful.
I got to admit, I can't read all the books that for the people that I interview on the show, but with C.S. Poe, because I did read the first book and was going to have her on a guest, I went ahead and skipped the other two, and I'm beginning the fourth book. And so far, I'm really enjoying it.
It's great. I mean, Sebastian Snow is an antique dealer. He has a shop called Snow's Antique Emporiums. He sells antiques and curiosities from the Victorian era, and he's a wealth of knowledge about that Victorian era. But as you know, with every amateur sleuth, dead bodies just pop up around him.
Just like it does for all of us every day.
Well, yeah, that's right. Nothing interrupts a day like a dead body. And this one is no exception. He gets a severed head delivered to him. I got to say, it's probably par for the course once in a while. So then his fiance, Calvin Winter, is a New York police detective who has been investigating all the mysteries in the other book. He has gotten his fill of Sebastian getting involved. He's gotten hurt. Sebastian's gotten hurt. And the Calvin superior and the police force has banned Sebastian from working on it. So this time, Sebastian swears he's not going to do it. Calvin insists that he's not going to do it. But as we get deeper into the book, the police really need Sebastian's knowledge of the Victorian era to solve this crime, and they ask him to step in. The nice thing about Poe is that everything has a historical basis to it.
Yeah, I know she studies a lot of history, so she puts that in her books. And it shows, I take it, in this one.
Yeah, this one is centered around the Bone Wars. The Bone Wars involved Edward Cope and Othniel. I don't know if that's his real, how to pronounce that first name. Othniel Charles Marsh. They were both paleontologists in the late 19th century. And there were a series of bone fields being discovered in Wyoming and Colorado, which they went and dug up and were engaged in a competition to find who could do the biggest, the most exciting bones and new dinosaur finds. And at some point, Cope rebuilt a dinosaur and ended up putting the skull on the wrong end so that it was sitting on the tail. And Marsh pointed it out, and that just made the feud even worse.
I wonder if that's where the term sticking your head up your ass comes from.
But it was sticking the ass up the head, so maybe not. The C.S. Poe gives you just enough of the history that you're intrigued, but you don't get stuck in the middle of a lecture and feel like you've got to learn and memorize the details. And then she builds the mystery on top of that. In this book, there were a lot of red herrings, more red herrings than usual. So not only do you have to figure out the clues, but you have to figure out which of the clues are important. This one gets a flaming recommendation.
And do tell, why does it get a flaming recommendation?
Well, because flaming is reserved for books that have a fair number of hot sex scenes.
Ooh.
Keep reading.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm just getting started. So what about Requeered Tales?
Well, Requeered Tales just released 2 days ago, The Unfinished by J.B. Laws. And it is a gay man moving into a cottage who is then haunted by the ghosts of all the previous gay men who lived and died in that cottage. And it's a series of frightening ghost tales for Halloween.
Perfect time of year.
Yeah. We're looking forward to getting that out into hands of readers. By the way, speaking of books that we want to hear about, we're looking for books to review. And people who want, are their books reviewed, even if they're not guests, even if they're not known, even if they're starting out, even if they're not new books, we want to see them. Send any books you want us to consider for review to info@gamemysteryauthors.com.
So again, that's info@gamemysteryauthors.com. Get those in so Justine can take a look and hopefully make a recommendation on the show. Yeah, I have Michael Nava coming up in a couple minutes here to interview.
Oh, I'm looking forward to listening to that. His new book sounds wonderful.
So thank you, and we'll see you next week, Justine.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction Group on Facebook. Links are on our website, gamemysteryauthors.com.
Hello, my guest today is Michael Nava, who I'm not only happy to have here as a guest, I'm actually honored to have him here today. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm great, Brad. Good to be here.
Welcome. Now, Michael Nava is the author of a series of mysteries featuring Henry Rios, a gay Latino criminal defense lawyer. The original seven novels were published between 1986 and 2000. Nava is reissuing a revised edition of the novels through his own publishing company, Persigo Press, and you're adding new books to the series. Now, the first new novel, Carved in Bone, is set in San Francisco in 1984 and is currently available. The Rios novels have been awarded 6 Lambda Literary Awards, and Nava was awarded the Bill Whitehead Award for Lifetime Contributions to LGBT Literature. Now, Michael, we're going to talk about you, but first, Henry. Tell us who...
Henry's more interesting than I am.
Oh, I doubt that. But tell us who Henry is.
So, as you said in your introduction, Rios is a gay Mexican-American from a working-class family in California who put himself through college and law school and became a criminal defense lawyer and practices in the novels primarily in Los Angeles, although there are a couple of other locations, and is someone who is... very much a defender of outsiders like himself.
Without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit more about his background?
He is. He begins as a public defender in a university town near San Francisco. And he ends up in Los Angeles. And the novels are set originally from the early 80s to about to the late 90s. So he gets caught up in the whole AIDS epidemic. And in the course of the novels, he meets and falls in love with a young man who is HIV positive. And part of the story of the novels is the unfolding of their relationship and how it impacts Rios and the cases that he handles.
Now, Carved in the Bone is the first Henry Rios novel in 20 years. Why'd you wait so long?
It took me that long before I had something new to say, frankly. And like Rios, I was also a lawyer. I retired a couple of years ago. So I had that career to attend to also. And for much of the last... the last book before Carved in Bone was published in 2000. And from 2000 until 2015, I was really focused on my legal career and what I was doing both in the law and in terms of some efforts I was involved in to diversify the legal profession in California. So that took up quite a lot of my time.
So you were busy.
I was very busy.
Now, your bio you gave me says that in addition to releasing previous books, that you are adding new books to the series, plural.
Right.
Can you tell me what we can expect?
So Carved in Bone is the first new book, and then there will be a sequel to Carved in Bone, which I hope to release next year, called Lies with Man. And then I want to add a book that's actually set in the present, as opposed to Carved in Bone is set in 1984. Lies with Man will be set in around 1986. Because I'm trying to fill some chronological holes that I didn't get around to when I was writing the original series. And then I want to bring it up to date. Because obviously a lot's happened since 2000 when the last book was published.
Okay, so you answered a question for me because I was curious as to why. Well, my first expectation was that Carved in the Bone was going to be a contemporary novel. Kind of surprised when it wasn't, but not unpleasantly surprised.
Right. So the way that, as you know, I mean, you're a writer yourself, and so the way that books get written is it takes a while. So it takes a year and a half to write a book. And during that year and a half, you're writing one book. Other things are happening in the world that you don't necessarily address. So all of my books, all of the Rios books, to some degree, they omitted events that were occurring at the time I was writing them. So when I went back, I looked, I saw there were a couple of big holes in the chronology of the books that I needed to go back and fill in.
Now, my first introduction to your stories wasn't through your books. It actually was through your podcast series of your first Henry Rios novel, The Little Death, which I give a glowing 5-star review. And it is still available. What possessed you to do the show?
So I actually, as part of this, as part of my going back and revisiting the series, I rewrote The Little Death, which was the first novel. It was originally published in 1986. I just meant to do a little revising and, you know, correct some errors, but I ended up rewriting the entire book, so much so that I gave it a different title because it was such a different book. So it was republished in 2015 as Lay Your Sleeping Head. I was just talking to someone about podcasts. I really didn't know much about them. And he said, you know, this would make a great podcast. And so I started listening to podcasts like Serial and S-Town. And I was very excited about the idea of presenting the Rios stories in a different kind of medium than books. So I thought, well, I'll try it. And I adapted the book into an 18-episode podcast series. I hired actors. I hired, you know, a composer to write original music and sound effects. And I turned it into an audio drama, like, you know, old-time radio. I wanted to bring him to life in a different way than just on the page. And since it seems quite unlikely he's ever going to be appear as a in a movie or a TV series, I thought this is a way to do that, to present him in a different medium.
Well, you did an excellent job of bringing him to life. I hope he does show up in some other medium, because it's well deserved on your behalf. Can we expect more podcast serial dramas in the future?
You know, the first, I didn't know what I was getting into. And there were lots of moving parts. And the first season cost around $30,000.
Oh, so, wow.
And that came mostly out of my pocket. So I'd like to do further seasons, but I've got to find a way to raise the money to do it, because I can't continue to subsidize it. And I'd like to do Carbon Bone, but that would be even more ambitious. So if I can raise the money, then yes, definitely I want to do additional seasons.
Yeah, because there's quite a few characters in Carbon Bone.
Yeah, they are. And so, you know, I mean, Lay Your Sleeping Head had, I ended up with about a dozen actors. Of course, hiring a studio to record it, and then a sound engineer to help me with the editing process, was all very expensive. So yeah, I really need to find a way to raise money if I'm going to proceed with the podcast.
Yeah, as a single host, simple podcaster, the $30,000 kind of, I understand. So that's certainly more than I have to pay for my little speaker here. Now, what would Henry Rios tell us about Michael Nava?
I really don't know what Henry would say about me. We have very different careers. I don't even know that we would have intersected. He is a trial lawyer and has been a trial lawyer his entire career. But I wasn't a criminal defense lawyer. I was actually a prosecutor, so he might feel some hostility toward me because I was on the wrong side of the law from his perspective. But most of my career, I worked behind the scenes in the court system, writing opinions for judges. So I doubt that he and I would have actually had much to do with each other.
Now, it seems some people have an antagonism towards prosecutors, which I don't understand, because obviously some people deserve to be prosecuted. How does that make you feel?
Well, I think actually most lay people think that prosecutors are the good guys in the criminal justice system. And I think that most of the hostility toward lawyers in the criminal justice system is reserved for defense lawyers like Rios, because people have the idea that criminal defense lawyers are basically getting guilty people off. And that perception has really been furthered by shows like, you know, Law and Order, in which the criminal defense attorneys are almost always portrayed as sort of sleazy characters who will do anything to get their guilty clients acquitted of crimes that they committed. You know, in my experience as an attorney, that's really a very profound misunderstanding of what criminal defense lawyers do. They're really indispensable to the system.
Well, the last time we spoke, you told me that Michael Nava's life isn't interesting, which I find laughable. You have an impressive law background, as you just stated. You've been an activist. I want to know, other than writing, what is your real passion?
Well, you know, I don't have any hobbies. And I don't really know how to answer that question. I mean, my entire life has either been writing novels or practicing law. And what motivates me in both cases is, you know, as a gay man from an ethnic minority, as, you know, my family's Mexican, I've just really been dedicated to try to increase the visibility of those communities, and in any way I could to make the society a little less bigoted toward us, whether it's toward gay people or Latinos. That's pretty much consumed my life.
And it shows in your writing. How has your background in law helped you with writing the Henry Rios stories?
Well, you know, a lot of the Rios books involve, actually have courtroom scenes where they involve fairly complicated legal maneuvers. And so being on the inside and having an understanding of how the law actually works has been indispensable. I recently read a mystery, which has gotten quite a bit of acclaim, which is a courtroom drama. And I couldn't read it because the courtroom stuff was so inaccurate. I understand why the author did that, because most trials are actually not that, they're kind of boring.
Yeah.
But the job of a writer is to take material that's boring in the real world and to make it interesting, to dramatize it, but without... but still, you know, remaining somewhat realistic. So my background in the law, I think, was really helpful in allowing me to dramatize the law without making a complete, while still remaining, you know, fairly true to how it actually works.
Yeah, I think a good example of what you're talking about, not necessarily law, but I know in television and movies and even in books, it seems like forensics gets their evidence back overnight to the law enforcement, which we know is absolutely not true.
Yeah, it's not true. And also, if you look at a show like CSI, occasionally when they do have courtroom scenes, you know, the forensic scientist is asked a few questions and makes some dramatic revelation. But if you actually read the transcript of someone testifying about DNA, that goes on for hours, and most of it is unbelievably technical and boring. So the stuff we see on TV bears very little relationship to what actually goes on in courtrooms.
Yeah, a friend of mine was on jury, I think it was last week, and she said that she knows more about the spinal column than she ever wanted to in her lifetime. So.
Right. And the other thing about trials is, you know, they're not straightforward. When you present your case as a prosecutor, you're presenting it often not in a chronological fashion because, you know, sometimes witnesses are unavailable on a particular day, and so you have to go with who you have that day. And sometimes you have to take witnesses out of order, and it's much more like putting together a mosaic than just presenting a straight chronological narrative of how something happened.
As far as I know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, your only other fiction work is a standalone novel, City of Palaces. Did you become especially partial to Henry or to just writing the series in general?
You mean, why did I write mysteries and not other novels?
Well, did you just do the Henry Rios mysteries and then the City of Palaces?
Yeah, that's my entire output of fiction so far. Why did I write the Rios mysteries? Well, I didn't set out to be a mystery writer, actually. I actually studied and thought I was going to be a poet. But when I started law school, I sort of lost interest in writing poetry, or maybe the law drove that out of my head. But I still wanted to write, and I thought, oh, I'll write a novel. And I wanted to write the kind of novel that would actually teach me how to write fiction, how to construct plots and develop characters and learn how to write dialogue. And so I'd always loved reading mysteries. And I thought, well, mysteries are very, from a point of view of the writer's craft, they're very demanding. And so if I write a mystery, I'll have to construct a plot. You know, I'll have to learn how to create characters, and they'll have to have snappy dialogue. So really, I wrote the first Rios book as an exercise in teaching myself how to write fiction. I didn't write it because I intended to write a mystery series. It just happened that the first two books kind of took off. And then I was asked to write other books in the series, and that's really how the series came about.
Yeah, as an exercise, I'd say you did a pretty damn good job.
Thanks.
So you kind of touched on it with the poetry. What's your background in writing? What was your journey?
So I started writing probably seriously when I was around 12. And from the time I was 12 until I was in my early 20s, and particularly in college, I was really only interested in writing poetry. So I studied under a number of poets. In college, I took a lot of English lit classes, although I was a history major, and I only wrote poetry. And I was really convinced this is going to be my vocation. I was going to be a great poet. So it wasn't until I got into law school. Once I graduated from college, I realized poets, you know, there's no real job for poets. I mean, you have to do something else if you're going to be a poet. I'd always also sort of been interested in politics and the law. So I went to law school. And once I got into law school, yeah, the poetry just dried up. And so, as I said, it was at that point that I sort of switched my writing goals from writing poetry to writing fiction. But I think writing poetry is really good training for writing fiction because it teaches you how to use language economically. And it teaches you a kind of precision when you have to write poetry, because in poetry, you don't get that many words to say something. So every word has to carry quite a bit of meaning. And that's a really good thing to know when you're writing fiction.
I've never heard it put that way, but that's an excellent point. Henry Rios has been extremely popular, and you've won 6 Lammy Awards. So few would argue your success, but what does literary success mean to you?
You know, I have an ego, and you know, it's gratifying to read good reviews or positive reviews for the books, and I'm grateful that I won those awards. It tells me that people are paying attention to what I'm doing, basically, and that more than anything else is important to me, because I don't write these mysteries just to entertain people, although I hope they entertain people, that they are compelling books, that people, you know, get very deeply involved in the characters and the story. But I also have kind of a mission in writing the books, and my mission is to talk about the experience of being a gay man, because we live in a society where being a gay person is still, you know, quite challenging, more now than ever, I think, given what's going on in, you know, in the political sphere. So, yeah, for me, success means reaching people who wouldn't ordinarily read about someone like Henry Rios, to read those books and to identify with him, even though they themselves are not gay or Latino.
Well, I'll tell you one of the successes you've had for me. I was closeted till I was in my 30s. So the AIDS crisis and that type of thing. I was in the South, and I was removed from all of that. So you really gave me an understanding of what was going on, and I'm quite impressed with how you've done that.
Well, then, you know, that's the kind of success I want, which is to bring people into my world and to have them learn something, and also to have them empathize with the characters I write about.
What, according to you, is the hardest thing about writing? What's your writing kryptonite?
I think first drafts are hard, really, because it's just you and the blank screen. And no matter how well you prepared yourself, just like squeezing those words out the first time around is always very challenging. It's always very exhausting. Once I have a draft, the revision process, I like that, because once I have a draft, it's like, you know, it's like making a map. It's like the Lewis and Clark expedition, trying to get from the Mississippi to the Oregon coast. You know, you're cutting that trail for the first time. Once you've done it, then you do have a map of how you got there, and you can go back and you can improve on it. But it's being in the bushes that first time that I find particularly exhausting and challenging.
Well, as a writer, it's comforting for me to know that you have the same challenges that I deal with.
It doesn't get easier. I don't think it gets easier. Every book is as difficult as the last book.
Well, thanks a lot. So, if to reach you or to purchase your books, what are the best ways for our readers to follow you?
So, my website is michaelnavarrider.com. Although actually I tend to post more on my Facebook page, which is also called Michael Nava Writer. And that's really where I communicate with people more frequently. And, you know, my books are available in the usual online places, but they're also available in print editions. And I encourage people to go to their favorite bookseller and ask them to order it, because my books are, you know, they're accessible in print editions. And if your bookstore doesn't carry them, it's easy enough for them to order them.
Yeah. I don't know where in your area, you're in San Francisco, correct?
Right.
Here in LA, we're seeing a resurgence of indie bookstores, and I'm hoping that's something that is happening nationwide.
Well, I think that predictions that ebooks would replace print books, that those predictions have proved to be not true. And I think generally there's a resurgence in print books. And I think that that's probably fueling some of the resurgence of independent bookstores. And I think, you know, independent bookstores, people who are starting them or people who are run them, they've learned some tough lessons. And they're probably running their stores much more efficiently and much more intelligently than they were 15 years ago when they were completely unprepared for the onslaught of Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot, the bookstores that survived, I think, are a lot being run a lot smarter than they were previously.
And as a writer, you don't hear it very often, but I have heard it told to me and some other writers that when someone says, I loved your ebook so much, I had to go buy the print edition.
Yeah, you know, I personally read most of my books as print books. I mean, I appreciate the convenience of ebooks, but I like to flip back and forth when I'm reading, and I find that much easier to do. And I'm just, I mean, I'm an old guy. I just turned 65, so I'm really habituated to reading print books, and I like them, although I run out of space for them.
Well, before I let you go, I ask every guest a question that authors hate to hear. So I'm going to I'm going to spin the wheel here and see what we come up for you.
All right.
Okay, here we go. Are your books any good?
Yeah, they are, actually. Because, you know, when I got the rights back to them and I started this process of revising and republishing them, I had to read them for the first time in 20 years. And I was really surprised at how well they held up. So, yeah, I'm a good writer.
I would agree with you 100%.
Thanks, Brad.
Glad you know it. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and definitely
an honor.
Thank
you so much.
As I said.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I hope we have you on again sometime soon in the future.
And best of luck with this podcast. It's really a great idea. I hope you get some traction. And I certainly will be putting it all over my social media.
Well, that's excellent to hear. My goal is that more people become aware of the genre that you and I are in and make it both good for the writers as well as the general public that needs to know that we're here.
Right. I agree totally.
Hey, you know that book you're reading? When you're done, please don't forget to leave a comment. Not only does it help the author feel better spiritually, but it is financially rewarding as well to help them keep more books coming.
Go to our website, gaymysteryauthors.com, for links to subscribe on your favorite podcast applications so you don't miss a single episode. You'll also find transcripts of this and other shows. We're here every week. Thank you for listening.